brief introduction about your background in engineering, just to crank it up. But before you came on board NASA, what you were doing, and just a little.
Well, let's see. I graduated from Duke University in 1948, BS in mechanical engineering, and my first job after graduation was with Ranger Aircraft Engines as a design analyst for about 2 years, and then I had about another year with then the old Glenn L. Martin Company as a structural test engineer. Then I joined the Army in the enlisted status for about a year, and volunteered for a direct officer assignment with another 3-year hitch, and part of that was to go to a guided missile school, which I didn't know too much about at that time, but it sounded like a pretty good thing to do. And they shipped me off to a place called Redstone Arsenal in some place in Alabama, which I couldn't find at the map on the map at those days. It was called Huntsville. And this was a provisional ordnance officer's guided missile school. Since that time, of course, it's grown into a tremendous complex. I was through class number 3 at that time. Started a new class each month, about a year. Learned a lot from that. From then graduating from that, the Army saw fit to send me out to Los Angeles to represent them in guided missile work to the local contractors out in the Los Angeles area. Nike, Corporal, dealing with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Firestone, Douglas, okay? And I spent a good 2.5 years there. Very interesting work, learning how to deal with contractors and how to represent the interests of a group of people a couple thousand miles away. And I thought that was a very interesting assignment.
Excuse me, is this mostly with electronics or with guidance or with propulsion?
Could be anything, to do from propulsion to guidance. Hmm. As a resident office, you're representing the interest of your mission arsenal, as you will, which is what this place was in the Army days, to the contractors. You work within the framework of the scope of work of the contract. You interpret the language of the contract, what we really mean by this, and roof changes, if it's within our prerogative to do so, refer them back to home base if it's too complicated. It isn't that you have to be a specialist in any one field, but you've got to be a specialist in identifying whether you're dealing with a very complicated problem or a very simple one.
Yeah.
Say. The idea is to know when to bring people out on such a long trip that require their special or whether you're dealing with something which is can be solved on the spot. Sometimes schedules will play a very important factor in determining whether you have to deal with this thing within a matter of 2 days and over the phone, or whether you can afford to take the time to set up a committee and really give it a good technical treatment.
Right.
So,
I
thought that was very, very interesting. After that, I came back here. And let's see, where did I go then? Oh, I was here for just a few months, and then they decided it'd be a good idea if this guy, Erlov, had a resident office of his own up in Detroit. So they sent me up to Detroit to represent the Army to Chrysler Corporation, who was then making the Redstone.
The Redstone, yeah.
And at that point in time, the Redstones were going out of their R&D phase into the operational phase, if you will.
Now, you were working, Von Braun was head of the engineering directorate or something at that time then?
Yeah. This was now in the ABMA days,
right,
with
right.
General Medeiros. He had just come in, he wasn't on the scene yet. It was Von Braun at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He came on the scene about 2 later. So I was involved in a resident office capacity for about 2.5 years up in Detroit, in Chrysler. During that time, we dealt with the Redstones in the operational phase, and also the initial design phases of Jupiter. Okay. Jupiter series was getting started then, and to us at that time, jumping from a Redstone to a Jupiter is like jumping from a Saturn 1B to a Saturn 5. Tremendous difference. And it was a lot of the similar work that I'd done on the West Coast, but I had my own office, my own staff. In that respect, I found the work very interesting. After about 2.5 years, I came back here, joined the Jupiter Program Office.
Excuse me, you had a military commission at this time, or you
were sorry, I was out of the Army then when I came back from the West Coast.
And you're at the West Coast. You were commissioned officer.
I was commissioned officer,
yeah.
First lieutenant.
Yeah.
And then when I was discharged from the Army, I decided to stay in the civil service capacity. Came back to the home base. Program office.
Right. Okay.
Redstone.
Mm-hmm.
And sent me up to Chrysler. Nineteen fifty-five. Went up to Chrysler. Came back down here about 57. Now about that time. 1958, General Medaris joined us. ADMA was deeply involved in transferring the Jupiter program to the Air Force. And then shortly after that, NASA was formed. I'm trying to remember the dates, but I just don't have a good memory for dates. I stayed on with ABMA for a year after NASA was formed, closed out the Jupiter program in the sense that we transferred it to the Air Force, and they in turn deployed them overseas. It was a very interesting assignment in that it involved some overseas travel and actual operational problems in Turkey and in Italy and getting these things set up. So that was a year well spent. When I joined NASA, I joined as the S1C project manager at that time. The S1C was not called S1C then, it was called S1B, which was a conflict to a previous vehicle called S1B. And here I was dealing with a stage called 1B, but that's the way
we had
a change that was confusing.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
But the 1B, or prototype 1C, was a four-engine jobby that was that had been competitively bid. Boeing had won the bid before I came on the scene, and I think a week after the announcement was made that Boeing had won that bid and was to be the prime contractor on the first stage of the Saturn V, then I joined over here under Dr. Lange and became instrumental in the 1C.
Okay, let me stop here because this is...
So anyway, that's my background.
Yeah.
This is precisely
the area that I really need some help in. The thing that really strikes the historian going through this thing is the close relationship that Marshall had with Boeing.
Mm.
Much more so than anybody else.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, what was the rationale? Why did they go this route?
Well, okay. First of all, there was a tremendous amount of work put on in-house in preparing the proposals for bid. The bids themselves were very well defined. We knew the diameter of the thing and the shape of the thing, even though it had four engines. We had a configuration that was well advanced in
house in?
I think because the S1C was a more natural derivative from Redstone and Jupiter. It was number one, LOX kerosene.
LOX RP1, yeah.
We're dealing with the old propellants as opposed to hydrogen and oxygen. Where Marshall Space Flight Center and our propulsion people had an expertise in this area, great. Going back over many years.
But the LH2 work was mostly at Lewis at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other thing was we had well along as a research project the development of the F1 engine. Okay? It didn't start when we started building the 1C. It had already gone through static firing.
At least since 1958, they started really cutting metal and stuff on it.
And we had, under the design control of Marshall, with Rocketdyne, say, a going hardware program with the F1 engine.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a more natural thing for us to do, to be more detailed in the design description of the 1C, or 1B1C.
Right.
It's not yet 1B1C, right? In putting out that bid. To get to your question then, Boeing was a new contractor to us. Boeing did not have previous large space vehicle experience. Okay?
Okay.
And they recognized this.
Douglas had already been working on the S4.
Douglas had experience on S4, which was now could be applied to 4B.
North American had been working on at least Navajo and stuff like that related to
it. I forget the names, but they were already in the hydrogen field. And then too, the S2, which was the brand new element in the whole Saturn V stack, had could draw on the experience of 4B, at least that. For instance, the engines are the same.
Right.
4B has one engine, S2 has five of them, but they're the same one. And so there was a link with history through 4B. But the only link with history for 1C was through Marshall into the Jupiter Redstone series. Can you imagine?
Yeah, here we go. No, I guess we don't have that.
So
it was matter.
We were intimately involved in the design definition of the 1B and 1 or first stage of that 5.
So it was largely a factor, if I can summarize here, that the engines were already getting into the hardware stage, or at least in the testing stage.
They had been static-fired as R&D engines.
And so, and the engines being linked so closely with the stage and LOX, RP1 combinations, that it was more natural for Marshall to go into this. Did they also go into it slightly because they wanted to accumulate more expertise in the dynamics of these exceptionally large diameter stages? Is that part of it too?
I don't think so. At least that doesn't ring any bell to me.
Yeah.
If I might be more practical at the moment, one thing that may have influenced it, my own opinion, is both S2, S4B were West Coast contractors, far removed from this place called Huntsville, Alabama, very difficult to communicate with and get to. They more or less let S2 and S4B be the complete design responsibility of the contractors, with very light involvement in day-to-day affairs and design development.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy involvement when there's a problem, of course. But one scene was designated for the shoe, say, 400 miles away.
Right, yeah.
A government facility, which was under our organizational control. MSHU was an extended arm of Marshall Space Flight Center. Okay? We had our own civil service people administrating the place, and we felt a closer relationship, a closer sense of responsibility to the first stage than we did to the others. I think that's at least my personal opinion. It had an influence. Why we went in a little bit deeper in 1C than the other.
Yeah. Okay.
Now,
yeah.
The other thing, and this again is a personal opinion, we had a contractor who won a very difficult bid, who had not had experience in large liquid propulsion stages, and who was used to, in past assignments, working with the Air Force, where they get a set of flight requirements, say, and a thin document, and go. They don't bother me until a year later, I'll show you the prototype. Okay. And we felt rather strongly that that mode of operation had to change. And so perhaps we overdid it. He said, Boeing, you're not going to go to Michoud, and you're not going to stay in Seattle. You're going to come here first. And Boeing, after they got over the shock, said, yes, sir, how many and when do you want? Say.
Well, this
he said,
well,
about 500, let's have them tomorrow. They came in 2 weeks later.
And that was the story around the old Hick building, right? You had
that
to find
some
place.
That was the Hick building, had to find a place for them.
And the Huntsville Industrial Expansion Committee, or whatever it was, they were the ones that did the Hick building, or did the government get in there and doing that?
No, Boeing did that.
Boeing went in there on their own and
Boeing was... as I recall it, leased that building for a specified period of time on condition that it would be upgraded to their standards by the tenant, okay? And so the financial arrangement was through Boeing. They set up the requirements for office layout, how they wanted it, how many people. They worked with the construction or modification contractor on that building. Now, how they found that building, what other buildings were available at the time, I don't know. We said, Boeing, we can't put you all here on the arsenal. There's not enough space. You'll have to find space in Huntsville. Okay? And so go do it, and the sooner the better. And they did. Their engineering talent now, okay, was integrated right into our labs. We had a couple hundred design engineers.
I remember there's one figure, at least 400 people out here at one time working on site.
Right on site, in the labs, on drafting boards, or with their slide rules, working hand in hand with the present people who knew the most about the stage. There was a thought in there that I wanted to get, and it escaped me. Well, I guess it'll come back. There was another reason for bringing Boeing to Huntsville also, and that is that in dealing with the manufacturing aspects, not the engineering aspects, but the manufacturing aspects of the S1C, we decided, civil service, government, decided that the first stages, first prototype stages, would be built here on base,
right,
assembled. That was the static firing bird, we called it the T-bird, okay? And we would build, the original plan called for the first three flight birds to be built.
I'm glad you mentioned
that,
because that changed.
That changed
yes.
Subsequently, okay? The reason for that was twofold. Number one, tooling was an unknown to us. This large welding assembly type tooling was something that we wanted to prototype first before we went into what we called hard tooling for production. Okay? And the way to work out the bugs in tooling, okay, is to build a set of what we called then soft tools, tools which could be changeable. Okay? And then once the bugs have been worked out of them, then you build your production tooling, which would automatically go to Michoud. Parallel to this thinking, Michoud was in horrible state. Okay? It was an old tank factory. It had substructures on the ceiling that interfered with the 33-foot diameter clearances. Cranes were located wrong. Floor loadings were wrong. Okay? And a major modification effort had to be gone on over there, which took at least a year and a half to 2 years. That vertical assembly building at Michoud had to be built.
Yeah.
Brand new.
Yeah.
bottom of shoe, you have to go down below ground as far as you go up just for the pilings. That stuff is all soft. Everything is built on pilings.
Really much. Yeah. There's no bedrock to put it on, as I recall. Yeah.
It was a long, hard process, which at many times irritated Dr. Reese. He would go down the shoe and he'd look at the progress and he'd say, "My God, here we want to get to the moon and you can't even put air conditioning in." And he really pushed us. Right? But here we had a schedule to meet. Right? We had the problems of prototype production to deal with. Right? So it was a natural to do the assembly work up here. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean the detailed work. It just means the major assembly, putting the whole thing together. Boeing was responsible for procuring the components, right? Building the tooling, soft and hard. Right? That's where Wichita got into the
action. I was going to ask you then, after you got the prototype more or less ironed out here, then the drawings and specifications went to Boeing at Wichita.
Mm-hmm.
And they built the hard tooling.
They built the soft tooling, too.
Okay. Oh, that's right. Then they sent it down here and it was tested out. And then the final specs for the hard tooling was let back there.
Yeah.
Some of it came.
Yeah.
Did it all go down to Michoud, or some of it come here then?
Probably
all went to Michoud.
Some of the soft tooling went to Michoud.
Yeah.
After we were done with it. And we have to be careful with terminology. I use the term soft tooling and hard tooling to distinguish between a prototype tooling phase and a production tooling phase. As it turned out, if you were to look at a particular tool, say, and say, ask yourself, is that soft tool or hard? They're both the same. They look the same. It turned out that way. There wasn't as many problems associated with, as we anticipated, in going from prototype operational phase to a production phase. It turned out that way. And I have to also give Wichita a lot of credit. Their tools were beautiful. They were really beautiful. They took great pains in putting these jigs and fixtures together. Well thought out. Documentation control on these things was as deep and as accurate as we would on a flight vehicle. We used Class 1 documentation control.
Were they the one that came up with the heat treat forming fixtures, or was that a Marshall thing? They came up with that on their own?
They came up with it. Well, no, I can't say that. Where the idea originated was here, along with another group of ideas that didn't materialize. We were looking into, for instance, explosive forming at the same time.
Yeah.
And then we were looking into bulge forming, which is what you referenced, say,
mm-hmm.
where you use pressures to form it. Say. And all of these were done under contracts out of our old mechanical and engineering lab. And some of those contracts weren't with Boeing. I think Wiley Labs was involved in one of them. I'm sketchy on that. Right. But the concept was originated here. But applying that concept to S1C and building the tool, it finally evolved out of that effort. That was done at Wichita. And the tool was at Wichita. The forming of the gore segments was a job that was finally done at Wichita. The welding of each segment was done first here at Marshall, and then finally at Wichita. Special welding fixture that was built by Wichita.
What about, when we're talking about tools, is that thing that Schwinghammer developed really a significant thing?
No. His magnetic hammer?
Yeah.
Yeah, we used that in reshaping, if you will, the slight imperfections that came out of the assembled bulkheads.
Mm-hmm.
It's a magnetic hammer, which shocks the material and gives it an energy shock in a very controllable manner. Boeing developed a portable handheld magnetic camera, right, where you could take a bulge in thin metal, which is very difficult to eliminate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Place this thing right over it, and by turning in certain dials on how much magnetic energy you want to sock this thing with, right, just flatten that thing out nice and smooth.
The thing that intrigued me about it, and what I've got to try and explain in history, is that to the reader it may seem like a fairly small thing. So you got a small bulge in a gore segment. As I recall, it's mostly for gore segments that they used. That were,
yeah,
especially around the fittings for the locks, the lock lines and so on. And I guess the answer why, one of the reasons it's so significant, is that each one of those gores must have been fantastically expensive. And if you lost one of the gores, what would it be? Several hundred thousand dollars to
I don't know what
go back and get the material and go through the whole manufacturing process.
Each gore was chemically milled on the inside.
Yeah.
Starting with about quarter inch thickness and then milling out to about an eighth in areas to get rid of the weight.
Did they continue with the chemical milling all the way through on those?
Oh yeah, all of them had that, except the T-Bird, the static firing bird, which was our first one we built. That had unmilled segments, since it was a non-flight bird. And it had to be a stronger bulkhead to withstand the increased pressures in the tank that were needed to simulate the lack of the gravity acceleration on the suction, if you follow me.
Getting back to the design aspect of it, how much can you say how much input into the basic S1C design Boeing made as opposed to Marshall? Was it primarily a Marshall design or primarily a Boeing design?
We had a phase there that we call pass the baton. And when you talk in preliminary concepts, that is, why did you what's the diameter, what's the length, What's the factors of safety, the pressure and requirements, the general layout, that's all Marshall.
Okay.
Now when you talk about converting an idea to a producible item in terms of detailed drawings now that you can contract on and specifications that you can contract on, And assembly techniques that are repeatable, that give repeatable results, as opposed to one-time prototypes, that was all gone.
Mm-hmm.
They did a tremendous job in an area where they had the expertise and we didn't. You get into building airplanes, and the whole process of drawing, generation, breakdown, control of quality, tool loadings, and how you make all the parts come together in a repeatable fashion one to the other. That's Boeing's got that expertise. We don't have that.
Yeah.
Here our expertise is in the R&D field and in initial prototype field. We can go in and solve a problem by putting a lot of people who have the technical expertise to do it, okay? But then once it's done, we walk away from it. We go to something else. But not production.
Can you explain to me the logic of going to separate tanks instead of using a common bulkhead?
Yeah. That was a design decision which was very early in the game, and the trade-off was this: in the S1C, it turns out that you have to save about 14 pounds of dead weight in order to gain 1 pound of payload, because it's the first stage. Here, on the S1C, weight is not as a critical a factor as it is in the upper stages, where, for instance, the second stage, I think the trade-off is 4 or 5 to 1 pound. Of course, the 4B was 1 to 1, and the IU was 1 to 1. Okay? So you don't gain much by having weight savings on the 1C compared to the rest of the stack. Therefore, we could afford to go to the simpler manufacturing method of double bulkhead, separable
common
bulkhead.
Common bulkhead raises all kinds
the common,
of...
The common bulkhead was strictly an effort to save weight,
mm-hmm.
say, by combining a single bulkhead to separate rocks and hydrogen, whereas on the 1C, it wasn't necessary.
Mm-hmm. There's another question I wanted to get in there, too.